Hi, I'm Karen. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Karen.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk to you all this evening. I'm always a little bit taken aback when somebody says, would you please tell your story? Because I feel like my story should be more exciting or more extravagant or more dramatic. And so when I first got sober, I wanted to be the baddest person in the room. But then I realized there were guys who'd done time in federal prison, and I didn't measure up, right? So I couldn't be the baddest person. And then I finally, after a time, came to realize that everyone's story is important, and a story is a story, and this is my story. It is what it is. I certainly didn't write it all. I might not have written it all this way, but I'm not totally sorry anymore. And when I first got sober, people were like, I don't regret my past. And I was like, you must be a moron, you know? I mean, I had so much regret. I felt terrible. I felt so ashamed when I first got here that all I could think of was I should have been someone else. I should have been born someone else. I should have had a different story. But that's not what happened. So I guess I start by saying I grew up in Northern Virginia, which is not really a place anymore. It's just kind of a bad attitude with a lot of traffic. And I don't want to go back, ever. But that's where I was born, into a family that was kind of a leave it to beaver, they thought. My mom thought so. She had been born into this idea that a woman didn't work in the home. She stayed home and took care of her kids. And that was her life. She was supposed to marry well or whatever, and that was the goal. It hasn't happened for me. But anyway, yeah, she looked forward to a life of raising her children, and that was it. My father was an American Indian man who didn't really acknowledge his heritage because he didn't know enough about it, so he was kind of like a white guy with a tan, you know, and who was also an alcoholic. And he didn't know that either when I was born. But what happened was I started to grow up in a kind of suburban white bread place and went to an elementary school with lots of other white kids, and it was like all this happy family thing. And then my dad left when I was 7. And that was really a defining moment for me because he and I identified in terms of our personalities. I am totally him, almost totally him. And that's kind of frightening because he died of cirrhosis not that long ago, about 6 years, and I'm jumping way ahead. But he had this depressive, alcoholic personality that I inherited, and that's not my fault or his. My mother, on the other hand, was a rather judgmental, kind of controlling person who wanted things to be a certain way and dusted her Venetian blinds every week, and everything was supposed to be pretty and nice and, you know, happy. And we weren't supposed to talk about things that made us uncomfortable. We weren't supposed to talk about being angry, especially. We weren't supposed to enter into conflict with other people because that wasn't nice. And so that was my family. And my father took off, and that just kind of rocked my world. And after that, I believed for some reason that it was my fault that he had left. I'm not quite sure why, because there was another woman involved, and it wasn't me. But in any event, he left, and I was left with my mother, and she and I didn't get along. So things went on fairly well up until I was about 16. I was one of those really good kids who got really good grades and did everything right because that's what I thought I was supposed to do. And for some reason, when I turned 16, it was like somebody threw a switch and the ugly came out. And I started doing stuff that I had never thought of doing. I had always been a church-going kid. You know, I was the one in the choir and all of that good stuff. And suddenly, I was going to bars. I was 16 years old. I got a fake ID. I hung out with some kids who weren't like the good kids. Curiously, one of my best friends was the daughter of the police chief. She and I were both bad kids at that point. And I started going to this bar called Bachelor's 2 in Fairfax. Bachelor's 2 has burned down because the Iranian owner of it burnt it down himself. But at that time, it was kind of like a meat market, You know, you would go in there and listen to music, and there was a long line to the ladies' room, and really loud music, and people would dance and try to pick each other up, and that's what we did back then. And here I was, 17 years old, totally just, I don't know, naive and kind of a moron when it came to working, you know, with the opposite sex. And people were, there were some regular guys there, and there were a lot of predators. And I had no idea what to do with a predator. There was one guy who would sit right outside the ladies' room. He was kind of an overweight, biker-type dude with a Rip Van Winkle beard. And every woman that came by, he'd go, "Hey, baby, let's get naked." And I always figured it must have worked once, you know? Like, because it never worked any other time. All the women were like, ah, you know, trying to, like, get away from this dude. But that was the environment. They had these things they called yards of beer. And when you're 18 back in Fairfax at that time, you could drink beer. And you had a little different colored stamp than the people who could drink liquor. But in any event, here were these yards of beer. It was 36 inches high. I don't know if anybody's encountered this thing. It looks like a vase. And when you pick it up to drink it, the beer starts flowing down. And if you don't drink, it flows all over your face. So I could never drink the whole yard. I could drink a half. But that's what we were doing. I was meeting people. I had no idea who they were. I was going out with guys. I had no idea, you know, what their intentions were. And I became that girl. What happened to me in the meantime was I had been out on some dates. I hadn't really figured out this whole relationship thing. And I started seeing a guy who picked me up from work one day. I was 16 at that point. And he said, okay, we got to go pick up some friends of mine. And I'm like, okay. So we picked up some friends of his, and I think they were drinking. I don't think I was drinking. I might have been. But in any event, the three of them and me ended up in a field, and they pulled a knife on me, and they did what guys like that do to girls like me. And I found out later that two of them did time for rape, because that's what they did on Saturday night, you know. And I was totally unprepared for that. I went home, and I told my mother, and my poor, you know, Leave It to Beaver mom was kind of totally freaked out, had no idea what to do with this information, and she said, "What's wrong with you? Why did you get in that car? You know, there must have been something the matter that you would have gotten in that car. It's your fault." And I thought, okay, well, and after that, it kind of changed my perspective on me. I mean, not like I had the greatest self-esteem anyway. I was already carrying all this business with my dad, and it was my fault that his life was messed up and all of that for some reason. But in any event, I stopped caring. And so when I became that girl, I was the girl who would take anything you handed to her. Whatever drug it was, it didn't matter. You know, here's a Quaalude. You know, I didn't even know what a Quaalude was. You know, I would do anything, stick it up my nose, throw it down my throat. I was the girl who was always passed out in the back of the car while everybody else was in the party having a good time. I was the girl who was puking in the toilet while everybody else was having a good time. And I was always thinking, what is wrong with me? Why can't I get this drinking thing down? It seemed to me like it was a problem of tolerance. And if I would just learn how to drink the right way, I would be able to have a good time. I wouldn't drink so much. I wouldn't be throwing up. I wouldn't be passing out. You know, I wouldn't be finding myself in compromising situations, wondering who this person's name is. You know, it was really kind of a scary time for me. And so I went on, I went to college, I hooked up with a biker and married him. That was kind of fun for a very short time. because he was an even bigger drinker than I was. And he was the guy who drank 21 tequila sunrises on our first date and stopped at the ABC store for a bottle on the way home. And I didn't see that as a red flag. Might have been an indicator, but it wasn't to me. I thought he was cute. He had nice eyes. And I got to ride on his motorcycle. And I don't know. He seemed like he had it together. You know, he was available. What can I say? So anyway, I married him. He wanted me. And I had a baby. And that woke me up a little bit to say that, you know, somebody's got to take care of this child. You know, I can't be falling around and not taking care of what's going on here. So I became the caretaker. And at that point, my life changed. And I stopped drinking and drugging and carrying on. And I became a somewhat responsible person because somebody had to be. It certainly wasn't going to be my husband. You know, he was like trying to figure out how to not work and still have an income so that he could drink enough to ride his motorcycle around and just, you know, be a kind of crazy guy all day. And that's how it was for a while, a very short while, because I dumped him and went back to live with my mom. She wasn't completely excited about that idea, but that's what happened. And so I had this little baby and finished school, and I met this other guy. And he was very romantic. He was a sailor. And he went off to the Merchant Marine on his ship, and I would sit there in my lighthouse with the smell of Old Spice wafting around and wait for him to come home from the sea. And it was a really bad idea. Because when he came home from the sea, he turned out to be a pot-smoking sociopath who was also abusive. So that was that marriage, and that went on for a couple of years, and I had a baby with him. So I have two babies at this point with two different fathers, and I'm single, and I'm living in a domestic violence shelter because that's where I go. You know, where else do you go? So I went there. Yeah, he kind of lost it, and I won't get into the whole details because our divorce was very ugly and very frightening. And as a result of the work that I was doing, I was learning more and more about all of the different kinds of dysfunction that were going on in my head. There were episodes during these periods where I would drink to the point where I would black out. That didn't seem a problem to me because if you had all of these issues, you would drink that much too, right? I had to forget what was going on with me. But they were brief, sporadic episodes like a binge drinker might engage in. And the rest of the time, I was taking care of somebody else who usually had a substance abuse problem because I had a really great radar system for attracting needy people to me. And I always said if there was a room full of 50 bankers and lawyers and successful guys and one needy alcoholic, I would go, he needs me. And that would be the guy, right? Right? I even said at one point, wouldn't it be good if the people who were dangerous for us would have a dot on their head so we would know, you know, not like a married Indian woman, but like just some kind of a signal. And I met a guy in a bar who had a dot on his head. He had a dot on his head because he fell down while he was drunk and hit his head on the corner of the table. And it was a scab in the middle of his head. But he was singing my favorite song. So guess what happened, you know? This was my story. This was my life as a young woman. Very needy, very sad. A lot of the time, looking for something to change the consciousness that I had because it was intolerable, you know. And something I read recently said that an addiction is kind of a realistic response to an intolerable reality. And that was my life. It seemed intolerable. Most of the time, when I wasn't drinking, I was sitting there smoking cigarettes like a fiend and drinking coffee all day. That's what I did, and feeling just miserable. I wasn't fun to be around. I can't imagine why anybody would want to be around me then. So after I was doing the domestic violence work for a while, I got into AA. And at this point, it wasn't me that needed AA. It was the other people, you know. And I knew some other people who were in AA, and so I wanted to be supportive. And so I started going to meetings. But the meetings that we went to, I'm not really sure what was going on because it was like nobody had sponsors that I knew of. Nobody worked the steps. Nobody did any of the things that are suggested as the tools that help us to recover. This was a group of people who sat around every week and told the same story. And it was just kind of weird, you know, somewhere in King George County, and they just had this little thing down that they did. And by then I was with another guy who was sober, but emotionally abusive, and who I think was more of a dry drunk than anything else, you know, so there was that to deal with. And he was, you know, just kind of loud and abusive in that way. Moved on from that eventually, and then, let's see what happened. I met the love of my life. Oh my gosh, yeah. And so there was that. And again, you know, episodes of drinking in and out, you know, going to bars, drinking too much, having to be rescued, somebody had to drive me home. It was always the same thing, you know, and I'm always thinking, why do I not drink the right way? Why can't I drink like someone who enjoys themselves? But I couldn't. And so I got into yet another relationship. This person didn't drink, and so I didn't drink. And that was the first time that I got cancer. So I had that to deal with, and he left me. And that's where it really kicked off, my whole drinking career, I guess. I had been practicing up until then, and at this point I decided I was going to become more of a professional, and I was going to enjoy drinking alcohol. And I did. I began to drink a lot on a regular basis, mostly at home, because by the time, you know, I would get done from work, I would be stressed, and I would hit the bottle, and I would spend the evening drinking. And that became my life for the next 10 years. So I built up, and I built up, and eventually I started to tear myself down. You know the story. This is what we do. And I became a reclusive, isolated introvert, which I've always been kind of introverted anyway. But I was the person who sat on the couch and drank until I passed out or fell into bed. And I thought that was called going to sleep. But mostly it was very sad, you know, just kind of lonely. And finally, my daughter had moved in with me. She decided she wanted to go back and finish school. And I said to her, and she has had a drinking problem throughout her life, I said, "Do you think I have a drinking problem?" And she said, "Yeah." And I was like, "That's not the right answer. Not what I wanted to hear." And I said, "Do you think I need to go to treatment?" And she said, "Yeah." I was like, "Oh." So I went to treatment. I went to an outpatient program, you know, every evening after work for 3 nights out of 7, and then you had one night where you're supposed to go to an AA meeting. And I really bonded with the people who were in that program. I understood them, you know. I felt for the first time like I might actually belong with these folks. Some of them were drug addicts. Most of them were alcoholics. Most of them didn't make it. You know, this is 4 years later. I can think of two who are still with us from that first group of people that I entered treatment with. And so I don't know how long that program lasted. It felt like about 2 years. It didn't last that long, but it helped, you know. And they asked me to do stuff like draw a picture of my powerlessness with alcohol. And my picture was me sitting in a black and white house at a table with two big bottles of alcohol and my dog sitting by me crying. And outside, it was colorful, and there was birds and music, and people were driving by laughing, and I was missing out on my life. I wasn't a part of my life anymore. And I realized that I had become my dad. That's what he did. He hit the door as soon as he got home from work. He started, you know, he couldn't really talk to you until he had about two. And he wouldn't have dinner until like 10:30 at night. And I always thought, well, that's so weird. Why would anyone want to eat so late? It didn't occur to me for about 10 years that it ruined his buzz. That's why he didn't want to drink. So he would make every kid in our family wait until 10 o'clock at night to eat so that he wouldn't mess up his buzz when we had our family gatherings. That's how it was. And I don't fault him anymore. You know, I've kind of gotten to this place where one of the things that we did in treatment was write a letter to our parents. And my dad had already died at that point. It was a horrible death, and I don't want to go through it myself, which is one reason I'm here. But I wrote a letter where I forgave him, you know, and I understood at that point that He loved me the way that he could, but it wasn't what I needed. I think that what I needed was something that no parent could have given me, and no man either, because I needed so much, you know, it was more and more and more, just like alcohol and drugs. I couldn't be loved enough. And what I've learned to do in this program is to begin to love myself. You know, I came in and everybody said, we'll love you till you can love yourself. And I was like, yeah, right. You know, that's not exactly what I thought, but I decided I wouldn't cuss tonight. So, you know, I came into the treatment program and I worked my way through and I got a sponsor who happens to be here tonight, which is very exciting to me. And I hooked up with her because she talked about her dad in a meeting. And I called her up and I said, will you be my sponsor? And she said, me? I'm like, yeah. So we worked our way through it and it helped, you know. I didn't like it at first. I had to read the big book out loud. And I would yawn all the time while I was reading. Because I didn't want to do it. I guess this was some subconscious, oh, I'm so tired. But I got through it. And I got through the steps and I just kind of moved on. And, you know, for the first 2.5 years, I don't know, I was on my pink cloud or whatever I was. I was happy. I was doing service work. I was going to the Thanksgiving dinner and cooking for all the people and everything was so great and I was so happy. And then I got cancer for a second time and I was still pretty upbeat. I was like, you know, the poster child for cancer recovery, and I was cleaning up my house and doing stuff outside while I was going through treatment, and everybody's like, oh, you're doing so great. And I got through the treatment and I collapsed because I was exhausted, right? And then my doctor said, we can't really give you oxycodone anymore because you're finished the treatment. And I got mad. I got real mad. And I decided that I deserved to feel better than I did. Because I don't always feel so great, you know. Cancer twice, it's not so good. I've got side effects. And I'm entitled to feel better. So I drank. I drank for a while. And it wasn't any better. It was worse. I sat in my house again. Because I got a DUI back in 2009. I sort of forgot that part. That was embarrassing and expensive and kind of horrible. And somebody who almost never speeds, you know, like here I am with the speeders and the crazy people and the guy who claimed that he drank mouthwash before the meeting and so he got kicked out, you know, stuff like that. And, you know, here I am, you know, this kind of, I thought I was a great, successful person, high-functioning, yeah, I'm all of that. I'm a high-functioning drunk is what I am. And it was hard to admit that. I didn't want to be that person. I thought, you know, of all the people that I know, I'm the least likely to become an alcoholic, right? Because most of my life I didn't drink. Except that when I did it inappropriately every time, almost every time. I never had, like, one, you know? What was the point? Why would you ever just have one? You know, these people who are like, I'm just going to have a drink. I'm like, nobody has a drink. It's always that's like a code word for a six-pack at least, you know, in my language. And what I had gotten up to was quite a lot of alcohol. I was very upset that I couldn't lose weight because I drank too much, not because I ate too much, you know. And what I found towards the end of this relapse drinking is that I was nearly suicidal. I was lonely. I sat there. I changed my consciousness to the point where I was numb, but it didn't feel any better. So even though I wasn't as bad off as I had been before because I was numb, I still wasn't happy. It wasn't working. You know, it wasn't what I needed. It didn't do what I needed it to do anymore. So I came back, which was not so embarrassing, you know, because other people have come back, and I'm okay with that. You know, they say, you know, people relapse to save the other ones, and I don't really believe that, you know. I don't believe that anything that has happened to me has happened so that I can help other people. That really irritates me. When people say, you know, God gave you this so that you could help others, what, sorry, what I've been through, you know, it's still not quite enough. But turn it around and say, if I can do something with what has happened to me, then it becomes valuable, you know? That's something that matters to me. So in my life, I have stepped out to help women who are victims of domestic violence. You know, I have stepped up to help other alcoholics because it is suggested that I do that. And when I get out of my own head, which is always a squirrel cage, I don't know, squirrels, monkeys, they're all in there. They're all messed up. It's a crazy cluster, you know what. Yeah, and so I have to shut that off, and in order to shut it off, I have to be focused on something outside of me. So when I'm able to help someone else or talk to anybody about what they've been through, it benefits me more than them, I think, you know. And that's kind of a self-centered way of looking at it, but at this point in my life, when you've had cancer twice, you know what's important. You know, my family is important, my friends are important, my people are important. And this community of AA is the people who have taught me to care about myself, to not be ashamed. You know, when I came in, I said it was like I had this giant bag of shame on my shoulders, and I felt like the Grinch after he stole all the stuff at Christmas. And I was just like hauling my bag of shame. I walked in wearing a sweatsuit, no makeup, no hair done, and it's just like a bag of sadness. And I hid in a corner, and I was like, please don't talk to me. I don't want anyone to speak to me, you know. And people did. Women reached out, and they gave me this paper full of phone numbers. I didn't know why. And, you know, here. And I'm like, okay. But they were kind. You know, and I didn't have the experience that some people do where they came in and saw everybody laughing and having a great time. What I saw was people who were calm, who seemed to have more of a handle on their life than I certainly did. People who had the ability to reach out, and I did not. You know, if someone said to me, how are you? I would say, fine. I would never say, and how are you? Because I didn't care how you were. I didn't care about anybody. You know, that's a terrible thing to say, but it's true. You know, I cared about me because I was a self-centered alcoholic. And that's what some of us, a lot of us do, you know. I was that person who was either always looking to be at the top of the heap or under the mountain because I was a worm, you know, hated myself but couldn't focus on anybody else. You know, it's all about me. You know, you look at me, what are you thinking? What you know, what's in your mind about, what's going through your mind about me? Well, you might be thinking about anything else, you know, but to me it's all about me. And what I've been able to do through this program is to get out of that, you know, the bondage of self we talk about. And that's exactly what it becomes. You think that you're focused on yourself and you're moving forward and you're making progress. But really, to me, it became bondage. It became sitting in my house, imprisoned, because I had to drink. And I couldn't go out. I'm going to get another DWI. I'm going to lose my job, right? So I'm stuck there, alone. I can't pick up the phone because I'm liable to say anything. You know, get on Facebook. God knows what I'm going to type out if I'm drunk. Did that a few times. Oops. You know, and I have friends, and I want to keep them. You know, so I can't be doing all that stuff. So I was left alone, and that's a horrible place to be for, you know, for me, maybe for anybody, you know, but it just felt like the walls were closing in and the cube was getting smaller, you know, like Superman, and I'm like, you know. Since I got into the program, things have changed so much, you know, even with the relapse, it didn't take me very long to realize that's not where I want to be. It's not where I belong anymore. AA screwed it up for me to enjoy my drinking, or maybe I just reached the end all by myself, you know. But I heard enough while I was here the first time to say, I need to be back. I own this chair. I've earned this chair, and I want to keep it. I don't want to go back to where I was, to the fate that I know awaits me if I keep on. You know, it's a desperate, sad, horrible fate. You know, I don't know if I'd ever have the guts to kill myself, but I don't really want to find out. And I don't want to go the other way because I saw it with my dad and it was horrible. Just not something that anyone should have to go through. Not like I want to pick the way that I go out, but those are two options that are not so good, right? So one of the options that is still available to me is to stay here if I keep coming back. You know, if I keep following the suggestions and using the tools of this program, I am entitled to stand in God's grace, you know, or whatever you want to call it, to feel that I have a relationship with a power greater than myself. And I had a big problem with that when I first came in. You know, I didn't want to hear all that God stuff. And to me, God was this old white guy with a big beard who sat on the cloud with a big long list like a negative Santa, you know. And it was like checking you off if you didn't do it right. You know, that was a God that I grew up with. And I thought, you know, this one guy really helped me in the rooms. He said, you don't have to believe in God. You just have to believe in a power greater than yourself. Like, whoa. You know, it can look any way. It can be the power of the group. And for a long time, that's what it was. You know, it was the power of this community to envelop the newcomer and bring them into a way of being that is so much better than how they get here. You know, we've all seen them slinking in here and would you sign my paper, you know, whatever. And I was that one. I was slinking in here. I didn't have a paper, but I was slinking, you know. There was a movie that came out right about that time, for I guess it was for kids, called Despicable Me. And I never saw the movie, but I saw the posters, and I was like, that's me. Despicable. I'm despicable. That poster is about me. I mean, that's just exactly how I felt. Like there was no hope. I was just going to be despicable. And I don't feel like that anymore. You know, one of the speakers that I most admire is Carla, and I got to hear her up this way a couple months ago or whenever that was. And she said, you know, I can go anywhere and not feel ashamed. And if you've heard her story, she would have had things to feel ashamed about. And knowing my story, I had things to feel ashamed about. And I don't feel like that anymore, because when I walk into a room, nobody knows that girl. You know, I know her. You know, I know what she's been through and how far she's come. And I don't want her to go back where she was. And I wish I could grab young women and go, don't do it. You know, don't go there. Don't go to that rotten bar. Stay away from that biker man, you know, or whatever it is. I want to help them to stay, you know, out of those situations. And I can't, you know, can't even help my own kids. But, you know, luckily they're on a decent path right now. So far, so good. But there are no guarantees. You know, I have no guarantee. I could just as easily go out tomorrow. So could any of us. And I guess if there's one complaint I have about AA, it is that sometimes we tend to venerate the seniority in AA and say, you know, oh, 30 years. Well, yeah, that's a long time. That's great. That's worth celebrating. But it doesn't mean that person is any farther from a drink than I am or the guy who just walked in, you know. And the other thing I think it's important to say is that I really like this idea that anyone can help anyone else, you know. If you have 30 days, you can help someone with 2 weeks. And if you have 3 days, you can help someone with 2 days. And there's always a way to help the next one in line, you know. So I think that's really important. So I would say, yeah, my sponsors, I've had a couple of sponsors, have been really critical to my success so far, my growth. The reading the literature and the big book. It was interesting the other day. I picked up the big book, and when I came into the program the first time, I had an older edition. And this time, I started reading some of the stories in the back. I was like, oh, my God, I never even saw these stories before. You know, it's like, wow. I never bothered to read past page 164 or whatever. I'm like, whoops. But Yeah, I'm just kind of at that place where I'm contemplating what it means to live in the moment, what it means to do what I can today, to keep myself sober, to do the next right thing, to help the next one in line, to keep in touch with my higher power, and to do what I know I need to do rather than what I want to do, because almost always, what did they say, the devil doesn't come dressed in a cape and a pointy tail, he comes as everything you ever wanted, because everything I ever wanted has been bad for me, almost always. You know, I got that wrong button, you know, every time I pushed it, it was like, no, that's not what I wanted, you know. That's just who I've been, but it's not who I have to stay, it's not who I am anymore. And I love the idea that I can walk into a room and feel like people there respect me, like because I've done whatever I can do, because I have a higher power that helps me to know what to do. I don't have to be that girl anymore. If I had stayed like that, you know, I might not be here today. If I was still here, I would certainly be miserable. You know, I wouldn't be standing here. So I guess that's about it. I don't know that I have anything else. It's about 20 till. So maybe other people could share about their experiences, because it's been a long road. I'm not done. But hopefully I'll keep trudging, right? Okay, thanks.